please help me welcome tonight's speaker, Adrian C. from New York City.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Adrian Clark. I'm an alcoholic.
Amen.
Good to be here. Thanks for the nice invitation to speak at a very popular group that I've spoken to a few people, including my sponsor, and he's given me great reports about you people here, and I felt the energy as soon as I walked in here tonight. He actually said this was one of the favorite groups that he spoke at, and I can see why. Very cheerful. Bunch of alcoholics in a wet night in the middle of nowhere. I want to thank Billy and Shannon for taking the ride up from New York City with me today. You know, I'm very grateful for the company on the way up. It's funny, you know, I was pulling out of my block today in New York, and I asked Shannon how he was doing, and we just pulled into the parking lot, and he just finished telling me. You know, so they kept me great company. I didn't have time to think about myself once on the way up here. And, you know, it's great to meet my good friend Sarah up here who, you know, she's a very dear person to me. We talk a lot on the phone. And, you know, I've got to show up one more day in Alcoholics Anonymous. And, when I came around Alcoholics Anonymous, by the way, let me just get this out of the way first. I'm actually from Ireland. I didn't get this action drinking Irish whiskey. I'm really Irish, okay? Just in case some of you are kind of, you know, we think funny, you know? So I got sober in Ireland, and, you know, when I first came around Alcoholics Anonymous, I had nowhere to go. I had nowhere else to go. And I remember showing up here. And I had a problem showing up my whole life. That's my real problem. I can't show up. I can't show up on time. I can't show up on the right day. Drunk or sober, I just can't show up. You know, I get sidetracked. But when I started showing up here in Alcoholics Anonymous, I started to see you people were showing up. And I'm a creature of habit. If you have something that I really, really want, my life depends on it, I'm either going to take it from you or do what you're doing to get it. And I watched you people show up in here. And you didn't have to tell me to show up. You did, but you didn't have to. I just started watching what you were doing, and I started showing up in here. One more day, and I've got to show up here tonight again. That's the most important thing you can do in Alcoholics Anonymous. Everything else will come after it if you can show up in here. And, you know, I've been doing that, and it's paid dividends for me in my life. My sober date's February 18th, 2001. And, you know, I haven't had a drink or a drug in that whole time frame, and that's not the miracle. The miracle for a person like me is that I've been able to fit back into society and been relatively happy in the meantime. Because I'm an alcoholic, and I did have periods of sobriety in my drinking. Not many, but I did have periods of sobriety. And what I thought sobriety was an endurance test where you had to hang on tight, and you're ready to jump out of your skin at any minute, but you just keep hanging on. And that's what sobriety meant to me. But it wasn't until I came here, till a man promised me something that I'd never heard tell of, didn't think was possible, where he promised me meaningful sobriety, that my life would mean something to me. I'd be able to fit back into society, and I'd start to experience things called happiness, joy, and freedom, like our literature talks about. And I asked him, where do you sign up? You know? I grew up in West Belfast at the time when it was basically a war zone. You know, where Ireland was at war with England, and I grew up on the streets of Belfast playing football with the Kennedys, you know, the Murphys and the McLaughlins and the McKeowns, and I mean real football. Not that sissy stuff you play over here with the helmets and the pads and the, you know, the guys wear like silver panties and like Christ. You got punched on the nose, and if you cried, you weren't allowed to play. And as you can see, I played a lot, you know. I grew up right on the streets of Belfast and right beside Bass Ireland Brewery. You know, I could smell the hops and everything getting brewed. And, you know, we'd be playing football on the street and practically in a war zone sometimes. The British Army would be driving around in armored trucks. And, you know, there was resentment number one. You know, these guys with foreign accents were monkey suits and SLR rifles, you know, coming in and taking my father away 5 a.m. in the morning, and I was wondering what they were doing. Like, you know, I mean, my father's an honest working man, and that was a resentment I formed pretty early. I got taught by the Christian Brothers. That was resentment number two. You know, these guys were black robes and leather straps inside them, and, you know, there was a lot of brutality and stuff went on. And I remember having waves of resentment when I was 4 years of age of how these people treated me. You know, and that was the beginning of my resentment inventory way back then. And I didn't know that till I came here. I didn't even know what resentment was. But I knew this. When I found alcohol, it took it away. You know, and I had a lot of resentment built up in me by the time I picked my first drink of alcohol up. And what's kind of funny is, I come from good people. I come from a good home. I'm the youngest of my family. And if anybody lived in a happy home, it was me. You know, I was taken care of. I had everything I ever needed. You know, I was brought away to Europe on a vacation every year to France or Spain. My father had a pretty good job, and you know, he really took care of us. I had nothing. I came from I had a functional childhood with everything was great in my house. It really was. One of my first dealings with alcohol was on a family vacation in a vineyard in Spain, when the family were doing some wine testing, and I was six, and I thought I'd have a bite at it. And I ended up walking into walls and stuff when I was 6 years of age. And I remember being drunk for the first time then, and it scared me. You know, I felt so sick. I felt this rush in my head, and I was like, whoa, you know, I'm staying away from that. And around that time, my obsession with alcohol had begun. I could see this Bass Ireland sign every day when I walked outside my house. I had that experience in Spain. And, you know, there was no alcohol in my house. And, you know, I had this obsession with alcohol. It was almost like a fight. It was almost like split into two halves. I will drink. I can't wait. It's going to be my initiation into manhood. And then this other said that, you know what, I want to be an athlete. I don't want to drink. And by the time I was 10, I'd quit drinking twice. You know, I really had, because I knew what alcohol done to people. I could see family parties and family gatherings and stuff in my house where certain aunts and certain uncles behaved funny when they took alcohol. You know, I mean, I'm from Ireland. It's a society of drinkers. It really is. And right up until I was like 13 years of age when I had my first real drink, I had so much fear going on in me. I really did. And I'd already started to have a lot of prejudice against God. I was brought up in a Catholic home, obviously, in the north of Ireland. You know, I had St. Anthony hanging on my wall, and I was brought to Mass every week by my parents. And, you know, I was brought up in a religious home. And, you know, you weren't allowed to swear. You weren't allowed to do anything like that. You had to have respect for your mother. And, you know, it was a pretty good home to grow up in. But there was a lot of fear going on. You know, already I was having conversations. I was having arguments with God. And I didn't really know what was going on. I really didn't. You know, I thought that, and I didn't learn this till I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I had this idea in the back of my head, if I was bad, that God was going to punish me. You know, and I'd already started to be bad. When I was 11 years of age, I made my confirmation. And I don't know if there's any Catholics in here, I'm sure there are, but when you make your confirmation back in the north of Ireland, you take a pledge that you're not going to touch alcohol till you're 18. And I remember thinking, what's the point in me even taking this? Because I broke it already. You know? And you had to get down on your knee and you had to kiss the bishop's ring. I mean, the one on his finger. And just so you know. And I took the pledge. I thought, you know, I took the pledge anyway, and that was it, you know. And a short time after that, I broke it, you know. And I was still at school, and I went to Glasgow one day to watch a soccer game. And I was in the bar before the game with my buddies. And we're sitting there, and, you know, it was suggested we'll have a couple of pints. And what happened to me that day was my first spiritual experience. You know, that thing happened to me that happens to us. I see some heads nodding. You know, where somewhere between my third and fourth pint of beer, this light come on inside of me, this get up and want to go to town party feeling that just knocked my socks right off. I mean, it was amazing. I hear people say that drink kind of changed them. This transformed me into a totally different character. The older ladies that were sitting beside us in the bar from Glasgow, I mean, these were tough chicks. Teeth missing, tattoos, everything. I was trying to hit on them. And, I mean, that's a transformation. My buddies were like, dude, calm down, will you? I'm up putting shirt on the jukebox, and I'm like, you know, I'm like, wow, this is unbelievable. How have I not found this before? And all that fear and everything that I had was taken away instantaneously. And I walked to that soccer game feeling 6 foot tall with my buddies. I'd finally fitted in. I really had. And that thing happened to me that first day in that bar in Glasgow that I hear so many people talk about in here. You know, that thing where if you're new, this is your entrance fee into Alcoholics Anonymous. It doesn't matter about the DWEs. It doesn't matter about the lockups. It matters about this and this only. Those things will help you in your experience. But what matters is, when I put alcohol in my body, did I lose control of it? And that day I lost control of it. I really did, and that's the thing that makes me alcoholic. There are other things that come along with it, but that's the thing right there that the book talks about, the common problem, the physical allergy to alcohol. Something happens to me that doesn't happen to regular people. It really doesn't. I've had conversations with my sister, and that day I lost control. I really did. I had that allergic reaction that it talks about in the book. And, you know, I've always known an allergic reaction to be something that sets you off wrong and makes you crazy. This was an allergic reaction that it just took that mirage away, and I just walked right out into life for the first time. I didn't like school. I didn't like authority. I was the youngest in my family. My parents still date, so they do. In fact, even when I was a kid, they dated, and my sisters had the job of mounting me. So they did, and they refused to do it after a while, because I had a problem with authority from day one, whether it was my sisters babysitting me, whether it was the Christian brothers in my school. I'd lost 5 jobs by the time I was 18. I just had a problem with authority. I really did. And I can tell you, that day in Glasgow, I didn't have a problem or anything. I really didn't. And when alcohol works on you like that, it's not a problem. I mean, it's not even a solution then. It's just amazing. And I didn't start drinking alcoholically from the start. At least I thought I didn't, until I met the guy that told me I was an alcoholic. And that was alcoholic drinking right there, from the start. You know, when did you have 3-4 pints of Coca-Cola? You know? I mean, maybe once in your life, if even. And I remember thinking that day in Glasgow, I'm checking how much money I have in my pocket, and I'm thinking, you know what? I've got the ferry ride home all the way to Glasgow, and or all the way to Belfast, and I'm thinking about getting back into that bar. And that began the start of my drinking. Something my sponsor talks about, he talks about there's 3 phases of alcoholism. There's the fun stage, then there's the fun problem stage, and then there's just the problem stage. I started drinking at the fun problem stage. There was consequences from the beginning, you know. But there are consequences that you can accept, you know. And thus began my journey drinking. And I didn't drink every day. I didn't drink every night. Not at the beginning. I started off as a Saturday drinker when I was still at school. Because I knew at school, I sitting there listening to teachers and stuff, which I eventually stopped going anyway. I was thinking, I've got my exit out of here on Saturday night. And I'd save my lunch money up, and I'd save it up all week, and I'd get myself a couple of bottles of Old English cider, and off I'd go Saturday night. Sometimes it was fun. Sometimes there'd be trouble. And right at the beginning, I started making trips to the emergency room in the Royal Victoria Hospital. Because something, all the stuff that had built up in me from school, from the Christian Brothers, from the streets of Belfast and stuff, when I was little Adrian, well, guess what? I wasn't little Adrian anymore when I found the alcohol and I got bigger. And it was payback time for everybody. It was payback time for the Christian Brothers. So it was, I got a bucket of golf balls. I'm my father's driver. And went over to the back garden facing the school and started driving off and smashed every window in the back school. You know, and that was the beginning of my amends list. You know, And everybody that gave me a tough time up until that point, I started to pay them back. Because you see, alcohol, I could do anything on it. Absolutely anything on it. And I found that out from the beginning. You know, something that I failed to mention. From I was a kid, from as far back I can remember, I got this other thing. It's called a soul sickness. It just has at every fiber of my being from as far back as I can remember, this uncomfortable feeling inside of me that just creeps up through me and nibbles at me and nags at me and nibbles at me, and it comes right up through my body. And I can content myself for periods of time with sports and girls and this and that, and I can keep it at bay for a while, but it just keeps going and it just keeps going, and eventually it starts washing through my mind with obsessions. Obsessions to do this, obsessions to do that. And I think that's when I passed from the phase of problem drinking into alcoholism. When it started washing through my mind with the obsession, you know what takes this away, Adrian? Yeah, but you got to go to work tomorrow. Yeah, but you'll make it to work. You know, and I wouldn't make it to work. And alcoholism, you know, it's something that, being a problem drinker is one thing, but alcoholism, not only do you have a problem when you're drinking, but you now have a problem when you're not drinking. And that's what began to happen to me. And this soul sickness would eat at me and eat at me and eat at me. And it was almost like The trouble started to intensify. The stakes would get bigger. The signposts would get bigger. And I didn't know. I couldn't see what was going on. I thought I was just having a good time. I thought I was having fun on alcohol. I got into a lot of trouble in Belfast, and I ran away to London when I was 17. So I did. And I just became another drunken Irishman in London. I didn't know what to do. I didn't, like I said at the beginning, I don't know how to show up. I had no money in London. And if you've no money, the best thing to do is look for a job. I didn't even have the brains to do that. I had no money for food, I had nothing. I was stealing food out of people's fridges to eat. And when I got money, I didn't buy food. And the alcoholism had kicked in right then and there. My sister found me in London, and she sent me back to Belfast. In fact, my father had to pay for my flight back. I went away to London again. Same thing happened again. My father had to pay for my flight back. I didn't know how to take care of myself. I didn't know how to show up for life. Drunk or sober, I didn't know. I just didn't have what it took to fit in, to live out there spiritually. And I couldn't understand why. I really couldn't. I seen people around me who were the same age as me and stuff, and they're starting to take off in life. They're going to college and stuff. My mom said to me, "You want to go to college?" I'm like, "Sure." She made the mistake of giving me the check to pay the college. And I went and sat in Belfast City Centre, and she thought I was going to college for months. I mean, it would have been easier just to go to college, you know? But that's how I thought. I couldn't connect these things together. When I left school to be a professional soccer player. That was my passion. That's what I wanted to be. That's what I really wanted to be. And I had a bad injury, and they still gave me a contract to play every day and to go to college. They were paying me money and stuff to do it. And we weren't 2 months into the apprenticeship when the guy who was running it, he called me to the side and he says, "Listen, man, you're a good player, but you got to show up here. I mean, you got to come and you got to train and you got to play." And I'm like, right, okay. And I just couldn't figure that out. And we were 5 months into the course and I still hadn't done a full week at it, you know. And right at the end of it, he had to let me go. He really did, and that was a heartbreaker. And that was the beginning of the dead end jobs and all that stuff. 1994. I started to become a very violent drunk. Before I was 20, I would get down on my knees before I'd go out drinking because I didn't know what was going to happen. See, there's two aspects to powerlessness for alcoholism. The first one is when I put alcohol in my body, I can't control the amount that I'm going to take. But the second one is I don't know what my actions are going to be. I really don't. Don't know, and I knew it back then. And before I'd go drinking on a Thursday, that was my starter off night, Thursday night. Started on a Saturday night, now it's moved back to Thursday and out to Monday. You know, it's progressed and it's been a downward spiral. And I'd get down on my knees and I'd say, "God, you know what? I know there's going to be trouble tonight. Can you just please take care of me?" And I remember my first sponsor telling me, "Adrian, that's powerlessness. I mean, I can't connect it up. I mean, you got a problem, Adrian. Why don't you just stop drinking?" That never occurred to me. That's how I think. It never occurred to me. And I'd go out and there'd be trouble. And 1994, June or July of 1994, this just come back to me recently. The reason how I can remember the date, because I'm useless with dates. I mean, I can't even remember last night, to be honest with you. But, you know, Ireland was playing in the World Cup, and it was 1994. So I was 20. I was born in 74. And we watched the game, and we'd been out drinking all day. And this is when my friends really started to talk to me. They're like, "Dude, you're out of control." We were out watching the game all day, and we'd been drinking and using Colombian agricultural products. This was at the time where Belfast was at the head of the troubles, and I come out of a blackout, running down a street, swinging a concrete pole, and there's a whole platoon of British soldiers in rat gear coming at me. And I can hear my buddy screaming, they've already got him. And I'm like, "Shit, what happened here?" And they got me, and they dragged me down that dark street in Belfast, and they done to me what they would do to a drunk Irishman, and there was no one around to save me. And they kicked my face in, kicked my teeth in, and put me up and down that street, and dragged me into the back of a tank. And they were lining up to play the drums in me. And, you know, to be fair, I can see where God was even in that situation. The charge hand or constable or whoever he was, he screamed, "This man's had enough. Don't touch him one more time." And they took me away in the back of an armoured tank and brought me to the Shankill Road, Tennant Street barracks, army barracks, and they brought me in there and stripped me half naked and they threw me in a cell. They took pictures of me. They printed me and they threw me into that cell. And I remember lying in that cell with my face and my head kicked in and my teeth dangling in the back of my throat. And I remember lying in that cell and just thinking to myself, what is wrong with you? And I got to tell you, I'm a prayer. And I'm praying to God, get me out of this one. But it's not God, get me out of this one, and we'll stop drinking. Because I don't think I got a problem with alcohol. I just don't see it. You know? I mean, that's a signpost, right? That you might have a problem, you do? No. And I get out on bail. And I remember getting out of that place and going, I need a drink. Not even thinking that, you know, I can't connect it up. I got into a lot of trouble with it. I went to court. Went in front of a magistrate. I did show up for court, but I hadn't got a lawyer with me. And the thought suggested it'd be a good idea, Adrian, if you had a lawyer to represent you here. So I got a lawyer at the last minute. And he said, dude, you're in a lot of trouble here. You know, you've got a charge sheet the length of this room. I mean, do you not think of getting a lawyer? And I just didn't know. And the magistrate cut me some slack. He gave me a fine and a suspended prison sentence if I'd get into any more trouble, that I would do that time plus some time. Belfast at that time is not really a place where you want to be doing time. And he let me go. And the way I thought I'd start my good behavior bond was by not paying the fine. I didn't think that. I didn't think he was serious when he said about the fine. So I didn't make the deadline for the fine. And they came looking for me again. And my parents had to face them, and they had to pay the fine. That was 1994. I didn't stop drinking until 2001. And let me tell you, it didn't get any better. It really didn't. And the streets of Belfast didn't get any better either. In between that, I had an older brother here in New York, and my father told him that he was worried about me and stuff, and would it be okay if I come over? And he said, come ahead, come over. 3 months I lasted in New York City. 3 months. It swallowed me up and it spat me out. And I started to hit bottoms, and I started to walk into depressions when I wasn't drinking. It scared me senseless. I didn't know what was going on. I didn't know what planet I was on. The distorted thinking, and the only thing that took that away from me was alcohol. And it had already stopped working. It wasn't working all the time. The partying wasn't, you know, I was drinking because I had to drink. And I left New York after 3 months with a bag of dirty laundry back to Belfast, not knowing if I was coming or going. Didn't know where I was going, didn't know what I was doing. And the trouble that I was getting into when I was drinking was just becoming worse and worse and worse. To the point where I didn't think I was going to reach 30. It's funny, I had a conversation with my father on the phone today, who still lives back in Ireland. And he said, where are you going, son? I said, I'm going up to Quaker Town to speak at an AA meeting tonight. And he was like, that AA's really served you good, hasn't it? And I'm like, yeah, it's been amazing, Dad, you know. It really has. My older brother fell off the top of the alcoholism tree 10 years before me. And I watched him fall, and I started falling behind him. He's still down in alcoholic death, and he's had time in Alcoholics Anonymous. So he has. He's had every detox, lockup, mental institution that you can think of. And I was falling right behind him doing the same things. And I just thought to myself, you know what? I'm going to get off here. And I've got off instead of. And me and my father both agreed I wouldn't have seen 30 if I had kept going the way I was going. I just didn't know how to behave. I really didn't. And I come from good people, like I said. I come out of another blackout. And I was in an emergency room, and there's a doctor holding me down. And there's another doctor shooting a Novocaine needle in through the top of my head where I'd been hit with an iron bar. And they're stapling my head back together. And I still can't connect it. Adrian, every time you get in trouble, you're drinking. You know, every time you get in trouble, you're drinking. And it just got uglier and uglier. To the point where I'm starting to worry. To the point where the darkness that would come to me when I was drinking, the alcohol wasn't giving me the buzz anymore. It really wasn't. I started coming to a place where I would fight it in my head. I'd be like, all right, I can do this. I can pull it together. It's just a drink. I'm going to stay away from it. And I got to tell you, when I was doing that, I couldn't stay away from it for more than, I couldn't get past the weekend. Couldn't do it. You know, I'd lost job after job. I'd show up on it. My work week started on a Tuesday or a Wednesday. And they'd give me another chance. I mean, these were dead-end jobs that you couldn't lose. And they'd give me another chance. And You know, I couldn't do it. I couldn't hold it together. And then I'd get a little period where everything would be good. I'd start playing football again. I'd meet a nice girl, and she wouldn't stick around for too long. And, you know, anybody that ever came close to me, you know, they seen my drinking problem. It piled up on me, and what happened was, after coming off a real bad run, I went home one night, and I went into my grandmother's bedroom in Belfast, and I went into her medicine cabinet, and I found the biggest bottle of pills that I could find. Didn't know what they were. I just couldn't do it anymore. I really couldn't. You know, I was hurting everybody. I've done a lot of horrendous, hideous things out there. I really have. Some of them still pull on my heartstrings. Some of them, a lot of amends has been made. But I got to tell you, see the thing that pulled on my heartstrings the most? It was the day my father, when I was walking out of his house, he cried in front of me. My father's a tough Irish man, so he is, who was a boxer, who had all kinds of respect in Belfast, so he did. And if you live in a city like Belfast in the 70s, the 80s, and the 90s, respect's a big thing. And he was a family man, and he'd done nothing but give me a good life, and I stole his life savings on him. And he cried in front of me, the tears were rolling down his cheeks, and he cried in front of me, and he said, "How can you do this to me after everything that I've done for you?" He said, "I want to die today." And I could see that he did want to die in his eyes. And I walked out of there, and I just couldn't get that image out of my head anymore, along with all the other images of the people crying in my face. Couldn't do it anymore. Alcohol doesn't work on that stuff anymore. It really doesn't. And I'm carrying this stuff with me, and I can't hold it together. My father wants me out of his house. My mother won't let me go because she knows what I'll do. And I come home that night, and I swallowed the whole bottle of pills, and I lay down to die. I just lay down to die, so I did. My next recollection was waking up a couple of days later in the Royal Victoria Hospital. And I just remember thinking, I'm still alive. And the image that he opened my eyes to was my father holding my hand, squeezing it, crying. And he's crying his eyes out. And he's saying, "Don't die, son." He says, "Because see, if you do, I'm going with you." And I remember that hitting home to me. And I remember psychiatrists around the bed asking me, "Are you going to do it again? Are you going to do it again?" And I'm like, "Dude, what? What are you talking about?" You know, and my sisters are around the bed and they're crying and they're asking me, "Is there anything we can do for you?" My sisters are normal, well-together people. And they're watching this fiasco and they don't understand it. But you want to know the sad thing? I don't understand it either. I don't know what's wrong with me. Because that's the devious nature of alcoholism. I don't know what's wrong with me. And they kept me in there. And I'm walking around a psych ward with the paper slippers on and the eagle's rebuilding itself. You know? I got this. I get this together. And I sent myself out of that place. And I went straight into the bar. And I'm pulling the electrodes off my chest and I'm crinkling them up and I'm flicking them into the ice tray and I'll sell with a double. Because I don't have a problem with alcohol. I really don't. Around that time, one of my buddies came to me and he was just out of prison. My best friend from 4 years of age right up. And he came to visit me when I was in that psych ward, and he says, "Well, what's wrong with you?" And I told him I had appendicitis. And he just started crying, and he said, "You know what?" He says, "I'm bringing you to see someone when you get out of here, man." And he brought me to see a psychologist who was also a priest, and I sat down in front of this man, and he said to me, "How much do you drink?" And I lied to him. And the lie that I told him, he was still able to pinpoint me. He said, "Son, you're an alcoholic, and I want you to go to Alcoholics Anonymous." And I'm like, "Really?" He goes, "Yeah, you're an alcoholic." And just to get him off my back, I thought, "Okay, let's get this together." He says, "Now, there's no doubt that you have other mental issues, Adrian. But, you know, let's start with Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'll see you as an outpatient." Now, I've been going to outpatients and stuff. I've never been to a detox or a rehab for the simple reason there are no detoxes or rehabs in the north of Ireland. There are none. Rehab was for some rich American in some movie. It was like a rehab? Are you kidding me? What would you want to go to one of them for? Detoxing people's sofas and stuff. I used to come home so messed up. I remember having the DTs when I was 20 years of age. I mean, there was snakes in my bed, rats running around my bedroom. I'm up banging my head off the window, and my father's trying to pull me down, and he said, "Listen, you're going for help the next morning." But help in Ireland, in the north of Ireland, is a doctor. And you go in and you sit down in front of them, and they don't know. I've been to doctors, psychiatrists, psychologists, and what they do is they aim for my mind. because it looks like I'm a psychopath, but I'm not. I'm not crazy at all. I don't know how to conduct my life, but I'm not crazy. And what they do is they shoot for my mind and they give me antidepressants, they alter the state of my mind and they do therapy on me and they do this and they do that. But you see, my problem only centers in my mind, like the book says. That's not where it starts. It centers there, but you know where it starts? It starts in this soul sickness that creeps up through my body. So it does. This spiritual malady that our literature talks about, and it comes through my mind. But they're hitting the wrong place. They're hitting it up here. It's too late hitting it up here. You got to hit it down here. And I started to come to Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, there was a guy who tried to 12-step me. He was one of my best friends who found a treatment center in Ireland. And he suggested Alcoholics Anonymous to me. He tried to 12-step me with a big book way back. And I didn't know what he was doing. But I was more interested. He told me, listen, there's a place where you can go. And I was like, really? He goes, yeah, hey, meetings, I've been going, man. I'm cleaned up, da-da-da-da-da. And I'm thinking, right, a room full of people in Ireland that's not drinking? I got to check this out. And I started going to me, him, and the priest psychologist had a sit down, and he said, take him to meetings with you. So I started going to meetings, but I thought you could drink going to them. And I'm like, I'm drunk in the meetings, and then they started talking about God and rigorous honesty, and I run right out. Are you kidding me? No way am I sharing that stuff. And I struggled with that for a while. But you know what? I seen something about you people when I came here, and I couldn't get it out of my head. I didn't know what it was, but there was a little light that went off in the back of my head when I seen new people in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I went out for another year, and I tell you, I hit the rocks bad. The craziness continued. The psychotic episodes, one escapade after another, just got worse and worse and worse. And I couldn't hold it together. I couldn't hold it together when I was drunk, and I couldn't hold it together when I was sober. The depressions when I was sober, and the craziness when I was... I couldn't be on my own. I had to drink. I couldn't shut the noise off in my head. And I started to have this argument in my head when I was coming home at night and stuff, when I was half drunk. Alcoholics Anonymous. The voice kept inside me kept telling me, go to Alcoholics Anonymous. Go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I couldn't shut that voice off. And I'm seeing the picture of my father crying, and I'm seeing all these other things that have went through in my life. And I know I'm going down the tubes. I know I'm in quicksand. And I thought, you know what? My last drunk was another weekend of pretty crazy stuff. It wasn't my worst, but it was pretty crazy stuff. And I remember coming home and going into the front bedroom of my parents' house like I always did, 3, 4 o'clock in the morning drunk. And I remember lying down there. And I woke up the next morning. And I remember looking at myself in the mirror, and I was numb, I was cold, I was white. I have a black eye, my face is scraped off me. And I said, you know what, I can't do this anymore. And what started to happen to me was a surrender started to take place through me. It had been trying to for the previous year. And it started to take place through me. And I got down on my knees and I said, God, I know you're there. And I need you. I want your help. And what started to happen, a significant series of events started to string together that I didn't know what was going on. I believe I took the second and third step that night. The first step was already taken. If you're here, you've taken the first step. You've taken it. First step's a conclusion. It's concluded, done deal, I'm powerless over alcohol and I can't manage my life. If you even when you get the first part right now, it's good enough. That'll get you started. And I had that first part down. And I thought, you know what, I'm going to go to one of the MAA meetings tomorrow night. And I walked. I had no cell phone. I had no nothing. I had nothing. I was living with my parents in the little front bedroom of the soccer bed, closed at 26 years of age. I'm an absolute success, you know. And I went back over. I walked and I got a bus and I went over to the AA meeting. I couldn't even remember what address it was, but I remember going over there and it was an hour early. And there was two guys fixing the door. And I said, "Is there a meeting here?" And they're like, "You're early, but are you a newcomer?" Well, I'm like, "Well, no, I've been here." Come on in, will you? And I went in, and they brought me upstairs and they got me a cup of coffee and they got me a big book and they sat down. And they sat there with me, so they did. And I'm shaking. And he's putting the coffee in my hand. And he's helping me drink it. And I tell you, driven by 100 forms of fear, I wanted to die. I really wanted to die. I didn't know what was in front of me. I didn't know where I was going. I didn't know what I was doing. And they brought me down to that meeting, and I can't remember one thing about it. But I remember a woman, and she said, if you don't have a sponsor, if you still have a home to go to, go home tonight and sit on the end of your bed and ask for one. And I remember taking that with me from that meeting. and sitting down at the end of my bed and asking for a sponsor. And I don't know what a sponsor is. If you want to know what a sponsor is, that's my brother. He's had more sponsors than the Super Bowl. So he has... And I thought, you know what? See whatever these people are doing in here? I'm going to do it. And I'm going to do it to the best of my ability. And I'm going to roll my sleeves up and I'm going to do it. See whatever they ask me to do, I'm going to do that too. And I started to show up at Alcoholics Anonymous every night. And I got to tell you, every night that I showed up at Alcoholics Anonymous, it got worse. The pain inside my head got worse. And I'm listening to this, and I'm listening to that, and I'm listening to everything, and I don't know what's going on, and I'm afraid. And if you're new and you're afraid in here tonight, this talk's for you. You know? That's the way it should be when you come here. You should be afraid. You know? And I was afraid. And it's amazing what happens. God put this man in front of me. See, I was used to all the older ladies and stuff. They were the only ones that would approach me in AA. And they'd come over, oh, keep coming back, son. You know, it works and this and that. And I'd keep coming back and I'd end up getting drunk and it wouldn't be okay. But I met this guy called Kevin and he showed up right in front of me. And he came right for me. I didn't know what he was doing, but he knew what he was doing. He says, how's it going? I'm like, to be honest with you, it's not too good. He said, really? He said, when's the last time you had a drink? I said, maybe a week ago. He goes, well, drinking is not your problem, is it? I'm like, well, what are you talking about? Well, what's my problem? He says, you really want to know? I said, sure. He goes, you're a self-centered prick. And I'm like, this guy's, he's messing around here. Like, I wanted to punch him in the face. I really did. And I'm like, what do you mean? And he's standing staring straight at me, wouldn't flinch. I said, I'm one of the nicest guys you'll ever meet in your whole life. And that's the delusion. I was convinced of it. He says, yeah, I know. He says, you'd give me the shirt off your back, wouldn't you? I said, yeah. He says, yeah, as long as there's something in underneath the table for you. I'm like, oof, I don't like this guy. You know, he's a little too honest for me. And he started prodding me. And I started crying right in front of him. I didn't punch him in the face at all. And he ripped that veil of ego right from me and he threw it right in the floor. And I started crying right in front of him. He says, come on, sit down. And I went over and he started talking to me. He says, see, when you start drinking, can you step by yourself? I'm like, no. He goes, that's a physical allergy. I'm like, really? He goes, you ever wake up and say you're not going to do it again? I'm like, yeah, all the time. He goes, that's a mental obsession. I'm like, really? He goes, you ever get away from it for a while and you get so crazy you got to drink to preserve your sanity? I'm like, yeah, all the time, that's me. He goes, well, if that be the case, maybe you're an alcoholic like me. And the gates of hell opened up for the first time in my life. I'd been to doctors. I'd been to everybody. I just wanted somebody to tell me what was wrong with me. I couldn't figure it out. And another alcoholic, the ex-problem drinker who's recovered, who's properly armed with the facts about himself, can win the entire confidence of another alcoholic in the matter of a couple of hours. He'd done it in 2 minutes. 2 minutes he'd done it in. You know? I'm like, well, what do I got to do about it? And he goes, I don't know. I really don't know. He says, but I can show you what I done. So I says, can I get some help from you? He says, you got a big book, Alcoholics Anonymous? I says, yeah, I got one. He says, I want you to go home tonight and I want you to read the first part of it. Give me a call when you've done it. I went home that night, read the first part of it and called him that night. And he came and picked me up the next morning, which I was impressed by. In the snow, he came and picked me up from my house and he brought me to his house and he opened the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. And he started reading it to me, and he started getting more into this physical allergy, this mental obsession. He started to talk about alcoholism and the depression and everything and all this stuff. And I tell you, I bust into tears. And I was really afraid because I started to see that I am an alcoholic. And I found that hard to accept. And I remember crying to him and saying, you know what, is it going to be all right? He goes, no, it's not. He says, it's all right now. I was like, wow. And I just believed this guy. He says, are you done? Are you done for good? I said, I want to be. He says, it's not too good when you're not drinking either, is it? I said, no. And he gets down on his knees. He says, well, you better join me down here. I'm thinking, you better join me down here? Can we at least pull the curtain? You know? I didn't say that, by the way, because I was afraid of him. I mean, I'm afraid of people. I'm afraid of people looking through the window from the streets that I've been dragged through and kicked and punched and everything, you know. And so I got down on my knees and I said that prayer, and I meant it. I meant it. You know, and he sent me away. And he showed me how to write inventory. And I got to tell you, it wasn't the best inventory that I've ever written. But it saved my bacon. And he started to show me the... I remember calling him up one day. And he asked me, how you doing? I said, I'm doing good. He goes, really? What's going on? I said, well, my boss is an SOB. I want to punch my mom in the face. My granny's driving me insane. He goes, how you doing? Good. That's resentment. I said, is that what that is? I said, I got tons of that. He goes, I know. I know. And we started working through this stuff. And I sat down and I'd done a solid inventory with him. And I threw it all out there. The sex with the sheep, everything, you know. I'm just kidding. You know, I threw it all out there. And I got to tell you, I went into that inventory thinking that I was Al Capone. I thought that I was some big tough gangster, and what I learned in front of him, that I was a little boy who was crying in the school kindergarten playground. And I started to make those amends. And he stayed with me my whole year of sobriety, and he started to show me how to live this way of life. He was like a walking big book. He really was. And I went to meetings with him. He would speak all around Ireland, the north of Ireland. He'd bring me into nut houses with him. Bring me on 12-step calls with him. And he really started to show me how to do this deal. And when I wasn't around for a couple of days, he'd call me up and he'd be like, where are you? I'm like, well, you know, I've been going to the gym every day, and you'll be the fittest man in the psych ward. I better see you tonight. I know what it's like to be in a psych ward with a six-pack. You look good in there, you know. You really do. And it's like you get the paper. It's not paper slippers anymore. It's like little socks with like little rubber spikes on the bottom of them. You know, they're upgrading it now. And he kept an eye on me. He did. And he was tough. He was tough, you know. And he tested my willingness to. And I spent my whole first year in Ireland with him in Alcoholics Anonymous. The day after my first AA birthday in Ireland, I come back to New York. So I did. When God wants to move you somewhere, you're going. I listened to the guys that, you know, I don't know whether I should do this job or take that job, but, I might be moving here. Oh, really? No. You're right, you don't know. Because when God wants to move you, you'll move. And the day after that, I was back in New York, and I got to tell you, I didn't know how I was going to stay sober. I'm a year sober. I'm leaving the support group. I'm leaving the sponsor. I'm leaving everybody, and I'm coming back to New York. And he came down to see me that day. And he came down, and he says, you know what to do. He says, find a guy as soon as you get there, and you got to find guys to start working with. That's maximum important. You got to find guys. And I was afraid. And I touched down in New York, looking for a new home group, and it was what seemed like a new AA, and I'm going to these meetings, and I'm standing on the firing line, because I came from a pretty good, strong big book group in Belfast, and I'm standing on the firing line, and I'm sharing about the big book, and I'm seeing it, I'm not getting a good response from all these old-timers down in New York. You know, these old-timers and their old-timerness. You know, kid, that's not how we do it here, you know, that's not how I get silver. We, you know, them steps are for fucking girls, you know, and I'm like, yeah, I can see that, you know, and, you know, my heart was ripped out of my chest, and I get on the phone, and I'm crying to my sponsor back in Ireland. He said, really? Is that what they're doing? He says, well, I want you to get back over there next week. You're going to do something about it. You go back in, and you carry that message again. And I go back in, and I carry that message again. And I stood on the firing line in New York by myself at a year sober with a message, sharing about this. And I kept calling him and telling him that I was doing it. He says, you wait and see what happens. I got a phone call one day, and there's a guy on the other side of the phone. He goes, you're that guy that talks about the big book around Woodside, aren't you? And I'm like, well, I mean, is that how you see me? You know? He says, man, you know, I was in the shower the other day, and I had a pistol in my mouth. He says, I was wondering, could you help me? And I'd been dying to say this for a whole year. I said to him, do you have a big book? He goes, yeah. I said, well, you better read the first 64 pages of it and call me back later. And he did. He called me, and he came over to my house, and I started reading it to him and sharing about the physics. And I tell you what, man, the lights, boof, started coming on. And the most amazing thing happened. before I even got him through the amends, or halfway through it, I got another phone call from him saying that he had two guys that wanted to do this with him. I'm like, he's got more sponsors than me. And what started to happen was we had a group in Woodside in no time. And you know the amazing thing about Alcoholics Anonymous is? Some of them guys that came into that group back then, they've been coming back into my life recently. Guys that come out of psych wards. Guys that come out of nut houses that they were just dead. They didn't even know their own names. And they've fitted back into society and they've done this deal. And they're living out there and they're sponsoring other people. And it's just amazing. And I've been able to stay sober the whole time. Unbelievable. And I didn't find a sponsor down in New York because I couldn't find one. I really couldn't. Not to the quality of sponsorship that I had back there in Ireland. And what I started to do was I got that big book out and I started reading it and I started writing deeper inventory and I started finding people to share it with and I got into my amends and I started doing this deal by myself. Don't recommend it, and you don't need to do that. You really don't. It's just the way my path was paved for me. And around 5 years sober, I'd had enough of doing that and my backside was falling off and the depression was back on me again. And that soul sickness was on me. And I'd done something that I learned to do in Belfast. I sat in the end of my bed and I prayed again. I said, God, I need another teacher. And the thing that kept me going right up until that point was sponsoring guys. And starting. I've always sponsored guys in Alcoholics Anonymous. See, if you don't do that, I don't know what's going to happen to you. That's the thing that keeps me sane and sober right there. The solution's always working with others. Always. Always. And we've got to get spiritually fit to do that. And I heard this voice on the other end of the phone of a guy who was going to ask to be my sponsor, and I explained to him what was going on. He brought me to page 52 of the book Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's where I was. He says, are you there? I said, I am. He said, you need to find a bigger God, buddy, that's all. And I can show you how to do that. And let me tell you something, I revisited the process, and I had a knock your socks off experience with the second step. It just came out of left field and shocked the life clean out of me. The experience that I had with it turned me upside down. And I had another experience with the steps, and the lights come on even brighter, and I really started to feel a part of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I've been doing the deal, that's it. You know, I go into detoxes, prisons whenever I can. I try and help as many guys as I can. And I get to stay in this beautiful fellowship. And I get to come up here and meet people like you. And I get to go to different places around the country and meet different people. And I showed up in Alcoholics Anonymous crying, afraid, and alone. And you know what? See, my sponsor, he told me it's not going to be all right. It is all right. Something I've learned in here. You don't have to work hard for everything to be okay. You really don't. You just have to work hard to see that it already is okay. Thanks for letting me share.